Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. My guest today is Stephen D. Smith. Steve is the Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of San Diego, where he's also co-director of the Institute for Law and Philosophy. Thanks for agreeing to talk with me today, Steve.
I look forward to it, Nate.
Steve has done a number of important pieces of work. He's a scholar of the First Amendment and particularly of issues surrounding religious freedom, but he also writes on the philosophy of law, and has recently published a book, Law's Quandary, with Harvard University Press. I guess not so recently. When did it come out?
Well, it actually came out, I guess, at the end of, 2004, though there's a paperback edition that just came out a month ago or something, so sort of recently out, I might say.
Now, is the paperback edition a revised edition? Did you change anything, or is it just the same book with a different cover?
It's the same book with a different cover. I didn't even see it. I'd sort of heard that they were going to put one out, but I didn't even have a chance to look at it before it came out.
Now, Law's Quandary, when it came out, got a fair amount of attention. There were a number of symposiums about the book, and you even got a glowing but critical review from Justice Scalia.
Right. Well, you know, when you do a book, you always hope it'll get reviewed or get some attention, and that book, this was a little bit of a surprise to me, I guess, but it shouldn't have been. It seems like it got attention mostly among sort of people who are interested in the Catholic natural law tradition, I say. So there were a couple of symposia on it. One was at Catholic University, and one was sponsored by Rick Garnett at Notre Dame. In some ways, this is sort of typical, though. I think the other kind of person who seems to be most engaged with that sort of book would be someone more in the, if you can use the term, postmodern or something like Jay Moot at Penn State. I don't know if that's the right term, but in my experience, there's often true that those kinds of polls can sometimes connect, whereas more just sort of mainstream thinkers may not be as interested in a particular piece of work.
Now, it's sort of unfair to ask you this question, but if you were to sort of summarize what your basic thesis in Law's Quandary is, how would you explain that?
Right. If you told me in advance, I would have worked out something more elegant. But I guess I think the answer would be that the argument is that law, as we know and practice it today, exists in what I call an ontological gap. That it seems to when we reflect consciously, when we're asked about it, and so forth, we disavow either believing in or at least basing law on a lot of the assumptions that would have been common a couple hundred years ago, going back to Aquinas and beyond, I suppose. And yet, if we inspect the way law works in our legal reasoning and so forth, it looks like an enterprise that still grows out of those kinds of presuppositions. So I call that sort of an ontological gap, one in which a practice goes on the basis of presuppositions, ontological presuppositions that it in fact disavows. That's, I think, the sort of central argument of the book.
Okay, so you use in the book a lot of examples drawn from constitutional law or federal statutory interpretation. And if I'm understanding it correctly, you would say something like, you know, when people talk about, say, a right to the free exercise of religion or a right to due process of law, when legal scholars or lawyers or judges are engaged in legal discourse, we tend to speak as though there's something out there that exists, that is the right to due process of law, or even more broadly speaking, the Constitution, or the law, and that's something about which judges can be right or wrong, something about which lawyers and law professors make these arguments that they're very committed to in terms of the legal correctness or incorrectness of their conclusions or the conclusions of others. But when we actually interrogate those assumptions, none of us is supposedly believes in, legal rights existing as some brooding omnipresence in the sky.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good statement of sort of a central theme in the book.
Now, Law's Quandary ends in with something of an aporia. You don't really have a lot of hope to offer to those who want a more sort of ontologically consistent way of talking, if you will.
Yes, it does, and I think that's something that some readers have found to be troubling or left them dissatisfied. I've heard quite often one of two responses, I guess, to that. One is it's just, you know, I ought to have done more to figure out what the solution to the problem is, or, you know, said something more definite at the end. The other is the suspicion that I really have an agenda, that I really favor one of the sort of diagnoses that I talk about in the last chapter, but I'm being sneaky or something, and I'm not not disclosing what it is.
What have you been accused of as having as your sort of real sneaky agenda? Have you been read consistently as having a sort of consistent secret agenda, or do you get differing readings from differing people?
The one I've heard the most, at least, is one that suggests that I'm pushing a sort of a classical theistic position, but just not quite owning up to it.
Justice Scalia says something like that in his review at the end of it.
He did, in a very funny passage.
Justice Scalia accuses you of not being willing to say the God word in your
right.
legal scholarship.
Yeah, he does say that, but I think others have thought that too. For example, Brian Bix, in a recent essay on the book, which I thought was quite a thoughtful essay and you know, very conscientious, but does read it, you know, as saying he seems to favor the kind of classical theistic view, and it's not clear that that would solve the problems either. That's sort of the, I think, the central theme in Bix's commentary on the book. So I've heard that from, you know, a number of sources, I think.
Now, I thought this was interesting, because as I was reading the book, and I confess that I had my suspicious moments as well, my suspicion, or at least when I had them, was that the sort of secret Smith agenda, if there was one, was actually a much more critical agenda, that you were much closer to the CLS or the crit position than was sort of made explicit in your book. At the end, I'm not sure I was still convinced of that. I'm just wondering if other people has read you as swinging on the other side of the swinging to the other pole.
I think I have encountered that too, but I can't think of specifically anything written that I think interprets it that way. What I've seen is, you know, more the other way. But I actually think, you know, both kinds of reactions are understandable, though, because maybe this is, I'm of mixed minds here or something, but I actually think I'm quite attracted to both themes. I'm not embarrassed about saying, you know, that my own sort of outlook is theistic, but I'm not sure that in many areas that does provide a good explanation for what we're doing, you know, in law or elsewhere and so forth. And I think maybe going back to my Colorado days, I think I've got a pretty strong sort of crit bent in me. So I think both of those themes are there. I mean, overall, I didn't think it would be good, even if I thought I had some solution to the problem, to sort of lay it out in the end. I really don't think I have any solution to the problem, but I tried to set the book up right from the first chapter as sort of Socratic in nature. And when you said it ends in aporia, you know, the Socratic dialogues that I guess I find sometimes the most intriguing and helpful are the aporetic dialogues, where that's what it ends with. And it seems to me that that's entirely appropriate, and I'm very happy to let people go in whatever direction they might think is the most promising from the sort of confusion that they have at the end. Now, you know, I think those questions are ones that I myself hope to continue to explore in other work, and it may be that I'll feel in a position to say something a little more concrete or definite at some point, but that's kind of the book ends with kind of the condition I felt like I was actually in, you know, at that point. So I thought that was the way it ought to end.
I'm wondering how you would respond. I was reading the book. I was thinking of how I would explain this to the students that I teach, most of whom tend to be fairly practical and professional-minded. Mm-hmm. And if I was to try to explain to them that everything that we're teaching them is based upon a deep-seated ontological incoherence, or at least a sort of conflicted ontological discourse, I think most of them would get glassy-eyed, or those that didn't get glassy-eyed would say, well, that's not something that really matters for the ordinary practice of law. That is, that I can go about my life as a lawyer, and judges can go about their lives as judges, and even law professors can go about their lives as law professors, without having to sort out these ontological difficulties. So even if Smith is right, his critique doesn't really touch law as it exists or practiced in any meaningful way. How would you respond to something like that?
Well, I think I would respond by saying that to a pretty large extent I agree with that. When I teach my remedies class, which I'll, you know, be doing tomorrow, I don't tend to bring up a lot about ontological gaps and difficulties and so forth. I think it seems apparent that we are able to function without without having resolved some of the issues that the book brings up, and how that's possible and why that's possible are themselves, I think, quite interesting questions, you know, what we're thinking about. Now, where I would disagree is that I think there are those, Michael Moore, who sort of writes in this area too, and person whom for whom I have a great deal of respect, but I find somewhat intimidating in his intellect, but you know, has an essay on the subject that in many ways is very good, but I think says at some point in the essay, none of this really matters to, you know, almost even, well, I guess it ultimately matters to our understanding of law, but it doesn't really affect other questions much. You know, there are just a few of us who kind of want to get it right. I don't think that's true. I think that there are implications for our sort of understanding of law and life generally, and that's what makes this sort of subject interesting to me. But I don't think that that you have to feel that you have an answer to questions of the kind raised in the book in order to practice law, you know, or make legal arguments and so forth.
It might sort of be useful, though, for lawyers in the dark hours of the night when they reflect on what they're doing.
Well, I would
hope so. Or
maybe
make the dark hours more dark.
Make them more dark. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess I don't think that the law's quandary is quite as desperate or hopeless as some other more purely skeptical or critical works might be. I don't think it needs to end that way. A couple people pointed out the last sentence of it as being troublesome or intriguing. I don't have the book in front of me right now, so I can't quote it, but it's something, you know, that we ought to recognize that there are richer realities that our meager philosophies have dreamed of. You know, I think that's right, and I don't think that's a particularly dark, you know, dark message.
Now, here's the last sentence. I do have the book in front of me.
Okay. It
says, but in the meantime, and as we look to be in the meantime for quite a while, and on the Socratic premise that it is the most blameworthy ignorance to believe that one knows what one does not know, we would perhaps be wise to confess our confusion and to acknowledge that there are richer realities and greater powers in the universe than our meager modern philosophies have dreamed of.
That's sort of a syntactic mouthful, isn't it? But, yeah, I mean, I don't think someone reading that would say this person is trying to project a message of, you know, bleak despair.
Now, you have written some follow-up pieces to Law's Quandary in which you tried to either respond to perhaps some of the criticisms or extend some of the arguments. And in particular, you have a piece that I believe is forthcoming in Notre Dame. Is that correct?
Are you talking about the...
The Always Imminent
right.
Death of Law.
It was actually written to be a lecture that I gave at Notre Dame, but it was recently published in the University of San Diego Law Review,
along with
some other papers from that conference.
But it has now been published.
Yes, uh-huh.
And in there, you start out by pointing out, and it's an interesting thing to think about once you've pointed it out, the ubiquity of predictions of the end of legal thought or legal discourse as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly are you talking about there?
Well, I think of this as sort of another take on this, the problem of the ontological gap. You know, if you look at a practice or a discourse and you see that it seems to be based on presuppositions that supposedly we no longer hold, then it's natural to suppose that, you know, it can't endure. It may persist for a while, but it's gonna have to change to be more in accordance with what we really believe about the world or the universe. And so there've been a whole series, during the 20th century, there were a whole series of predictions of that kind, you know, that law as we've traditionally practiced it can't continue. It's gonna have to change to, you know, be something more in accordance with what we currently believe. So, I think I list a number of those early on in that article.
Yeah, you have
just another way of talking, as I say, about this ontological gap.
Now, what's interesting, or at least was interesting to me, as you were going through that catalog of thinkers, is, you know, you start with Holmes, who, writing at the very end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, famously argues that previous thinkers, classical formalists like Langdell, thought of law as this sort of brooding omnipresence in the sky. But that we shouldn't really believe that anymore. Law is just this human instrument of policy, political interests, and that notion of law as sort of existing as something that, one can refer to evaluate the correctness of legal claims, that's something that's going to fall on the wayside. And
right.
So you get this sort of notion, right, that we're sitting in this liminal space, right? We're like the Edwardian vicar who has lost his faith in God but hasn't yet given up on religious discourse. But it's
right.
Just a matter of time before we all do.
Still go down and go through the rituals and so forth, but it can't continue for too long.
Right. And you point out that we sort of have been continuing along this way for quite some time. That it's been more than a century now since Holmes predicted the end of law as we know it. And Richard Posner, you know, has lamented that Holmes was right, but nobody seems to have been listening for the last century.
Right.
So why do you think there's that persistence?
Well, that's the sort of the same question that I end up with in Law's Quandary, and then again, I think in that lecture, because I think there are sort of different responses that you can give to that, but they fall, I think, into two main categories. One kind of response is that it takes longer than we might have thought for traditional practices to die out, even though they are not grounded in what we currently believe. I think my old colleague Pierre Schlag, for example, I used to have lots of discussions and occasionally co-author things and so forth. That's probably the answer that he would give. The other kind of answer, I think, is maybe we actually believe in some of the presuppositions more than we are aware of or own up to, in academic moments of discussion of those assumptions. That, I think, is a little bit more the sort of view that my friend Joe Vining at Michigan takes on these. And I think both of them are possible interpretations. Here we get back to the question you asked me earlier, but I find myself sort of somewhat in between or maybe with a foot in both camps because I think we do probably at some level believe a lot more than we own up to. That's a simplistic statement of what's obviously a very complicated matter. On the other hand, I'm not sure that the presuppositions would support all of or a good deal of what we do in practicing law. So, as I said, that's why I remain somewhat ambivalent in the end about what interpretation to offer.
Now, you end that lecture with a reference to another Socratic dialogue, the Meno. right? Where Socrates argues in the Meno that knowledge or learning is a form of remembering or recognition of what one already knows.
Right.
And you suggest that that something similar to that may be what is happening when people make legal arguments or are persuaded back and forth by legal arguments. What exactly do you mean by that reference and this notion of recognition?
Well, as I think I say in the lecture, that was in some, people who had read a draft of it had pointed out to me, and they were certainly right, that was a pretty underdeveloped idea in the lecture, and I think that's true, it is underdeveloped. But what I'm just trying to think about there is something like this, that a lot of reasoning in law, but not just in law, doesn't really seem to have the character of, that we even think of in connection with, say, more like formal reasoning, deductive reasoning, and so forth. It seems to have a different kind of character in which we are using it to give sort of like fragmentary descriptions or clues or reminders that help us to recognize something that we in some sense already know or at least already have the ability to see is there. That's why I describe it as sort of like partial description. So legal reasoning, I think, typically doesn't succeed by compelling somebody through a deductive process to realize, you know, that this is the conclusion that they have to reach. It's more indeterminate than that. There are, you know, arguments that can be made for different conclusions and so forth. At the same time, it doesn't seem to be just a facade for some completely other kind of reasoning, you know, as sort of like law and perspectives might suggest. And it does seem to have some kind of force. You know, you listen to a legal argument and people do come to a conviction that, you know, the Constitution really does mean this, or, you know, it doesn't mean that, and so forth. So I'm just trying to think about what is happening with that sort of reasoning, and it seems to me that it fits better under what I think I call in there something like an assisted recognition function than a more formal or deductive kind of function. But exactly what it's recognizing and how it works seem to me to be complicated questions that I don't think the lecture purports to give any answer to.
No, it sort of thrown out there as a tantalizing and interesting idea. The reference to the Meno got me thinking, right? As I recall, it's been a long time since I read that, but as I recall, Socrates ends up making this argument, right, is that in the famous, there's a slave boy passage in the Meno,
right,
where Socrates walks the slave boy, the sort of quintessential ignorant person, through a geometric proof. And at the end of it, the slave boy is able to understand, this relatively complicated, mathematical proof. And Socrates makes the argument that what the slave boy is doing is remembering something that he already knew. And that that notion of knowledge as remembering is sort of tied up with Platonic metaphysics, right? That
yeah.
There was this point at which our souls sort of frolicked among the forms, and knew, of these truths, and then we sort of remember them here, later on as we learn things.
Right.
And I sort of was wondering, well, if law is this sort of recognition, what exactly is it that we are recognizing, when I, you know, become persuaded that the due process clause really does mean X?
Yeah, right. Well, first of all, I might just note, this is, I guess, tangential, that obviously the dialogue itself is susceptible of different interpretations.
Absolutely.
There, I'm sure, scholars who think that Plato was not serious about that doctrine, that maybe it was more of a spoof or something.
Right.
Though it does come up in other dialogues too, I think, such as Phaedo. So,
absolutely. And I would not pretend to be qualified to offer, anything like an authoritative or intelligent interpretation of Plato.
Yeah, me either. So, absolutely. But I'll say, so your main question is, what is it recognizing? Well, this again would be this question about the, you know, in Law's Quandary, it's talked about the sort of transcendent law, or the law, I think I put it in quotes or something, behind the law, the sort of human positive law. The notion that there's some sort of normative order, and that legal reasoning is sort of helping us, is designed to be helping us to, in some sense, discern what that is and implement it, admittedly specifying or determining it a lot, because I think, you know, classical legal thinkers would certainly not say that, you know, there's a sort of normative or transcendent law, normative order, transcendent law that are fully worked out with all of the detail that human positive law has to do. But nonetheless, you know, the thought is that there is something like that, and that human law, positive law, is trying to ascertain and implement and specify it. That would be the suggestion, you know, that legal reasoning, this I take it would not have been, seemed like a particularly bizarre notion to classical legal thinkers, perhaps, but, you know, the notion that through legal reasoning we are working to ascertain and implement that more transcendent law. That's the suggestion, I think.
Our little exchange about Plato brings up another very interesting issue, I think, about law's quandary, and that is the way in which you wrote the book and have done legal philosophy in this book. For those who read legal philosophy, right, we tend to sort of, or there's a very important strand of legal philosophy at any rate that sort of traces its genesis back to the work of H.L.A. Hart, and has proceeded forward using the tools of analytic philosophy, and the tendency of that line of thinking is to become increasingly technical and specialized, and increasingly tied into the broader conversations of analytic in analytic philosophy, particularly methodological conversations, and perhaps less tied to concrete issues of legal doctrine or legal argument. It's a sort of massive generalization, but if you'll go with me on that for a minute, you seem to be self-consciously trying to write legal philosophy in a very different way, to try and use language that is as unspecialized philosophically as possible. And is directed much more toward the concerns or the sorts of issues that are faced in sort of more ordinary discussions of legal doctrine. I'm just curious as to what you see as the way in which you are trying to do legal philosophy and who you sort of see as your potential audience and interlocutors.
Yeah, well, I think you're definitely right about the sort of the form that the book takes and that I take in other writings, and, you know, noticing that that's a difference. It is a pretty self-conscious choice on my part. I mean, actually, I suppose it's a choice. I'm not really trained, you know, I minored in philosophy as an undergraduate, but I'm not really, you know, trained philosophically, and I realized that by not using the more technical sort of approach, the work will be less likely to appeal to people who, you know, have that kind of training and like to do that kind of work. And I also want to be careful when I talk about these things, because I, you know, have friends and colleagues and other people who do that kind of work, and I don't really want, I risk sometimes being careless and looking like I'm demeaning that sort of work and so forth, and I don't mean to be doing that. But have it with that caveat, I'll probably go ahead and violate what I just said, because I do have the sense that work in jurisprudence has, I guess I think there's sort of two dimensions of this. The technical, the highly technical approach is alienating or off-putting. It's sort of a barrier to many, many readers, I think. And I think that's unfortunate, because jurisprudence ought to be something that students generally, professors generally could have some interest in, you know, and I'm afraid that has become less and less the case in recent years. So that's just sort of the question of presentation. The other dimension, though, is that my own sense is that, again, this is with all due respect to some of the, you know, tremendous intellectual achievements in the tradition you mentioned, the sort of H.L.A. Hart with increasing refinements of Hart's type of jurisprudence that's occurred. With all, you know, due respect to, you know, I find some of it, you know, just extremely impressive. I have the sense that it has, that it is not really speaking in substance to questions that most lawyers or most human beings care much about. I don't think all scholarship needs to do that. So, you know, once again, that's not necessarily a criticism of it. For my own sake, though, this is partly just perhaps laziness on my part, but I think it's more than that. I just can't sustain the interest in something if it doesn't at some point connect up with real sort of human, let's say, existential concerns. And I think law can and should be able to do that. So, both in presentation but also in substance, in a book like Law's Quandary, I'm really trying to depart from that style of doing legal philosophy. And as I say, I know that will mean that that kind of work will not gain the same kind of respect among those who really do the technical work, and that's okay. But the hope is that, you know, that even they or some of them will find, you know, something of substance, but also, you know, worth caring about in a book like that or in that kind of work, but also that it might be able to connect the subject a little more with matters of real interest to people other than, you know, real specialists. And I think I say that right in the preface, you know, right off. I'm trying to depart from that tradition of doing legal philosophy, for better or worse, whether it really takes or not.
What would you say to sort of criticisms of that position? I'm thinking, for example, Brian Leiter has written a number of things in which he's argued, I think, fairly aggressively that a lot of legal philosophy as it's done in the legal academy is largely duplicative and worthless, precisely because without working through arguments in great and technical detail, it's difficult to evaluate whether or not they're sound or valid arguments. And then also that because people doing sort of non-technical legal philosophy in the legal academy are not fully aware of all the work that's been done in the philosophy of language or in moral philosophy, that they're sort of reinventing the wheel constantly and mucking around with questions where there's already sort of deep philosophical work that's been done that people would be better served trying to advance that conversation rather than simply reinventing it in the pages of the law reviews.
Well, yeah, Brian Leiter, you know, is probably one of the most prominent, I think, and, you know, forceful advocates of that point of view. And those of us who don't necessarily share that point of view may not know exactly how to take that. I mean, I guess I tend to think there's probably some truth in that. There's also a certain amount of turf protection, you know, that those of us who have PhDs in philosophy are the ones who are trained to do this, and other people really, and, you know, unless they make the effort to master it, can't do it. And the value, as you've suggested, I think, of doing that is supposed to be rigor and so forth. I mean, that's one of the main values. And what can I say? I guess I think it's fine to be as rigorous as you can. I no doubt would be well served by being more so at times. On the other hand, I think rigor can be overvalued. I mean, sometimes you can only achieve rigor by not talking about the subjects that are most important because they don't lend themselves to a particular kind of technique and so forth. So there are trade-offs each way, and I think, you know, those with the technical expertise go ahead and do their work, and they ought also to be willing to address other people and show if there's any real payoff in the method that they're using. And if there is, good. But in the meantime, I think it's unhealthy to suggest that, you know, jurisprudence should be such an exclusive field that only those with a particular kind of training were willing to use a particular kind of method, you know, are doing much. And in the end, you might say the test is, you know, show what the payoff is. of different sorts of approaches. I suspect each one may have its virtues, but I don't think anybody has a monopoly on how to approach these kinds of questions. I've already said, I think, you know, my just sort of assessment of the state of the world today is that jurisprudence work has suffered from over-specialization, both in terms of its presentation and its substance. And so, you know, it's a gamble, but, you know, the gamble is trying to do it some other way, to see if it can't be, have a kind of vitality that it seems to lack today.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nboman@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William & Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.